because fear was the one thing that'll kill you in your success as a dentist and as a business person.
Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm David Keir, and this episode we're talking with Dr. Harry Margot. Harry is known as Dr. Call Me, and I found this really intriguing when I learnt about it, but I've seen multiple posts on Facebook and other forums where he has simply said, call me, to someone who's in trouble, someone who needs advice or help. And often this advice is around dental practice, practice ownership and business, but at the same time, he's helped many people through his dental career. And I think it's so great to hear from him on the podcast. Now, Harry's known as Dr. Call Me, but he really is a genuine person who wants to help many people. I let him know I live in a certain area, and soon after, there was quite a big fire in that area. He messaged me that same day to see if me and my family were okay, and I think that just shows he's a genuine, caring person. But he's also got a lot of experience, and he does it himself. He has a massive practice. There's over 17 dentists, and they're very successful. So there's a lot of information in here, as well as learning about him and his stories and his history. We talk a little bit about some important topics like depression and suicide. I think these things don't come up enough. We need to talk about it more because it is a real thing and a real problem. We talk about Harry's career, we talk about his mentors, we talk about his business, and we talk about him helping others and his advice for others. There's a lot of stuff in here. It's a great chat. I hope you enjoy it. And today we have the Prime Head Start segment with Philip Palmer. Now, Philip's also a business wizard. He's someone who you go to for coaching and advice, and he started Prime Practice. So we talk about business mistakes in the Prime Head Start segment today. And I know we are aimed at students and graduates. That's what I'm doing this for. But I think this is really important stuff for us to know as an associate or as someone who may want to one day own a practice. So I'm sure you'll enjoy that as well. Don't forget, there's huge discounts for students and first year graduates to their course, and there's discounts for everyone else as well. 50% for students, 15% for everyone else. The last thing I want to mention today is we have finally released at least the pre-order for our dental journal with Foresight Dental. So this journal is made to give you clarity, focus, and help you get a bit of perspective on your dental career. It's something that can guide your learning and something that, if used every day, will help focus you into a better clinician. The idea from this was because I was told to do something similar by someone when I was in dental school, and it really helped. And together with Amit Azami, we've created this, and we're excited to get out there and hope we help a lot of people. Check it out, foresightdental.com/journal. If you use the discount code PREORDERFREE, you'll get free shipping and you'll get a free ticket to our webinar in January. Learn more at Foresight Dental. For now, enjoy the podcast with Dr. Harry Margot. Graduation from dentistry was one of my biggest achievements. I can remember the feeling so well. If you're about to graduate, congratulations, mammoth achievement, well done. BOQ Specialist also wants to say congratulations, and the way they're going to do it is to give you a chance to win one of 10 $1,000 Flight Centre gift cards if you're a 2019 graduate in dentistry, medicine, or vet studies. What better way to celebrate than to go travelling or to pay for some CPD travel next year? So if you want a chance to win a $1,000 Flight Centre gift card, then simply go to the link in the show notes, enter your details, and like them on Facebook. That's Pulse by BOQ Specialist. But make sure you do this by the 13th of December 2019 to put yourself in the draw. Terms and conditions apply. Check it out in the show notes and good luck. Authorised by Permit Numbers New South Wales, LTPS 1939049, ACT TP1904432, SA T1917151. What a mouthful. So welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. Today we have Harry Margot. How are you today, Harry?
I'm absolutely fine, David. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I'm always happy and more than happy to be able to work with young men who are breaking out into the area of education in dentistry as you are. I wish you well, and I'm glad to be part of your team.
Thanks, Harry. I appreciate those kind words. You actually are someone who... It does something that I think is really important, which is you help graduates, you help dentists, you mentor a lot of people. And first I want to say I've read a lot about what you've done for people and the kind words people have said. So I think from Australasian Dentistry, we want to say thank you for everything you do.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the first things I want to ask you, Harry, why do you spend so much time helping people?
I'm glad you asked me that question. There are predominantly two main reasons. One is historical, and that is because I am the son of surviving Holocaust victims from the Second World War. And one of the things that my parents taught me, because they didn't have much education, was that it's extremely important in this world if you have some knowledge and you have some skill and there are people who can use and develop that skill and knowledge, you definitely should share it with them. And so from a heartfelt message from two very elderly people who passed away just recently, that was the predominant reason. The second reason, even simpler than that, when I started out in dentistry, there was absolutely nobody, and I mean absolutely nobody, that would hold out their hand and guide you and help you. And I found that a real struggle. The first 2 years of my professional working life were filled with great anxiety, and I thought, you know, that's just not good. That's not a great way to get started. And I've actually lost a lot of men over the last 10 years that have been dentists that have passed away, some by their own hand. It occurred to me, I don't want to make it too graphic, but it occurred to me that it might be better if I had the opportunity to, and, you know, it does tire me out to help other people, especially young people. And young people were reaching out to me. I thought that's a great way to do it. So I just thought this is a good thing to do, and it allows me to give back. And prior to doing the job I'm doing now, I was roaming around the country working in clinics, government clinics and Aboriginal clinics for free just to help out. So I get a good feeling from helping out, David. I'm sorry to make that such a long-winded answer. But
no, it's a beautiful answer, actually. You've obviously got a few reasons for your giving, and I think giving is a really important thing. When we have knowledge or when we have skills or when we just have time for someone, it's pretty important. So I think that's really, really kind. I have actually seen you write before on a forum, "I don't want anyone else dying due to depression." Do you think depression and anxiety is still as rife as it was when you were a graduate?
David, it's worse. It's much, much worse. Sadly to say, just last weekend, and I won't mention names for obvious reasons, I was in a practice where, to be put it, don't put it bluntly, the dentist was ready to just give up and walk out and possibly walk onto the main road and get hit by a truck. Bad it was. He was being bullied and marginalised by his staff. I hadn't seen a situation like that in probably 10 years. But when I roam around the country and I talk to young dentists, the predominant thing I get is this. I get statements like, you know, this is really hard for me. I'm finding this very, very hard. Now, in the 1970s, when I was beginning, you know, we didn't talk like that. We just got out there. It was, you know, it was what it was. We were particularly busy. You know, we didn't have a lot of stuff. We didn't have a lot of technology. You know, we had composite resin that you had to mix with a spatula before you even got it in the mouth.
Yeah.
Got all this technology. And the young dentists are finding it hard. I tell you the thing that bothers me most of all, David, is that I feel, quite candidly, I'm going to say this, the training that they're getting at the universities at the moment is very, very underrated. A lot of them are coming out with absolutely no skill set. You know, they have not done a molar endo. They have not done a crown prep. Some, if I can believe what I heard 2 days ago, did not know how to take alginate impressions for splints. I mean, people think I make this stuff up, but, you know, I'm there. I hear this stuff firsthand. So the level of anxiety and depression amongst young dentists is horrendous. It's actually horrendous, and so much so that even a colleague of mine, again, I won't mention names, but everybody will know who it is, in far north Queensland, who I knew there was something up when I'd ring him and I'd say, I'll just use a pseudonym, "G'day, Peter, how are you?" He'd say, "Oh, look, I'm fine, Harry." I said, "No, I can hear it in your voice." He said, "I'm telling you I'm fine." And I knew there were warning signs, and I tried to stop it and rang his sister and his brother, and before I could do anything, he'd come down to Melbourne and stepped off a balcony and killed himself. The anxiety and depression levels are at an extreme level. And I don't think the so-called authorities, and I won't mention names, but you know who I'm talking about, are doing anything, or if they are doing anything, they're not doing enough to do something about it. Because a simple paragraph in the ADA magazine, there you go, I've said it, saying, you know, if you're feeling, you know, as stressed or anxious, call us up. And what's with the dental board? You know, APRA send out these warning messages. At the bottom of the page, it says, if you're feeling stressed or anxious about this, get in touch with your doctor. Don't do anything stupid. I mean, come on. If the authorities that are governing us are saying, if you're feeling stressed and anxious, what hope is there? So if you're wondering why I'm trying to do my little thing by myself, I'm out there trying to help these young people before they end up like this, Dave.
Yeah, certainly. And you sound passionate about it, and it's such an important thing. I think it's something that for many years has swept under the rug, and I think it's good to hear someone like yourself talking about it. And more than that, someone like yourself trying to do your part to help with that.
Yeah.
What do you think is the way out of this for people?
There are three things that I think need to happen immediately. And I recently wrote about this in Australasian Dentist magazine. I said I really feel that there should be a band, you know, of mentors, you know, probably 200 or 400 Australia-wide that young dentists can call on at any time of the day or night, and they'll step in and help them. I really think there needs to be a mentorship or an apprenticeship program set up for young dentists graduating today, because a lot of them are coming out with no skills. Not only do they lack the technical skills, they lack the speaking skills to do what they need to do. So I think that's step number one. Step number two, obviously there needs to be a bunch of money put aside for this to occur, because you're not going to get people giving up their day-to-day lives, you know, like I do, to go and do this sort of stuff for nothing. It's hard making a living in dentistry today. So there needs to be some money set aside, and I believe, and I said this probably to my detriment, that APRA or the ADA or one of the bodies that collect fees on behalf of dentists should put some of this money to good use and provide mentorship training programs for dentists. It's one thing to insist you go and DCP, but there's no point in stressing to some poor dentist that's just come out of one of the universities, go and get your CPD points, when he can't work out what to do with a broken tooth he's got sitting in front of him with a pair of forceps and a patient looking up with sad eyes saying, what are you going to do now, doctor? So, you know, I think there needs to be some awareness created. It's the old story, David. You know, people go and buy what they really want to buy. You know, you don't have to sell someone something they really want. You know, when somebody goes in to buy a Rolls-Royce, they walk in because they know they've got the money, they want Rolls-Royce, they've been educated, they know what they want to buy. The problem with this companionship program in dentistry is that no one's prepared to say that there's a big problem there. You know, I'm sort of like a voice in the wilderness. The ADA and Dental Board, you know, make cursory comments about it, but it's a huge problem. I mean, if I'm seeing what I'm seeing and I'm just one person, it must be there multiple times, multiple times.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's out there, and there's no doubt that it needs to be addressed. And I think there's a couple of things students or graduates should be doing, which is the first thing as well is reaching out to their peer group. When you were when you graduated and you were feeling that anxiety that you felt, how did you find reaching out to people? Did you go about it that way, or did you deal with it in some other way?
Well, what happened with me was I left Adelaide. I graduated the 24th of December, do you believe? And on the 20th of December, Christmas Day, I was actually working in a practice in Hawthorne in Melbourne, Christmas Day. And I can remember clearly there were 16 patients booked in, and there were another 10 or 12 on the phone by the middle of the day that had broken teeth on Thrupney boots, hit in the face with a cricket ball from the brand new cricket set, punched in the face with a football that they just got for Christmas, you name it. By the end of the day, I was completely frazzled. You know, I was up to my armpits in extractions and endo tools. I hadn't eaten lunch. I was completely exhausted. And I thought, this can't go on. Well, the same thing occurred the next day and the next day. What I did is I went to, you know, the so-called authorities, shall we say, like the dental hospital, the ADA, and I said, is anybody out there that can help me, give me some advice? I got a very simple no, there isn't. It just isn't. So what I did when I'd accumulated enough money, I just started traveling overseas. So what I did, I found things that I needed to learn or wanted to know, whether they're in the United States or England or India or Canada or Argentina, you know, whether it was bonding or cosmetics or surgery or sedation, whatever. I just found places. I probably spent the best part of 8 to 10 years after graduation just traveling the world, learning what I needed to learn, and not just technical stuff, but how to cope with being a dentist. Now, I also spent probably the best part of 2 years at the Royal Melbourne Hospital learning to do hypnosis, which was very helpful. And I actually became a clinical hypnotherapist, which mainly I used that technique on myself just to calm myself down.
We'll get into that later, actually. That's an interesting point.
Yeah. So that was one way. And the other thing I did, because I've always been into sport, I just found that I just played a lot more sport. It didn't really help me cope with the dentistry, but it gave me some ways of just sort of relaxing myself mentally and socially to cope with it. After that, I found that I just started knocking on doors. You know, I went down Collins Street. I just got in the lift in the TNG building and went up and down the building and knocked on dentist doors and said, is there any chance I could come in and watch you for half an hour or an hour? And most of the time I got a flat no, but then there were a couple of men who said, yeah, why not? Yeah, come in, you know, and I'd like to mention their names, but they don't really want to be mentioned. So a couple of men said, you come in and have a look. And these men were great. They gave me the opportunity to learn and not so much mentor, but at least I could see there was a simpler way to do this. I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that my role now with a lot of the mentoring I do is basically just saying, look, there's an easy way to do this. Let's show you how to do it. Let's give you some guidance. I mean, I'm not rolling up my sleeves and doing molar end. I'm just talking to people and giving them ideas.
But that's true. And it's a lot easier to learn from someone else's mistakes than it is to make your own mistakes over and over.
You got it. And the thing is, most of these young dentists, David, sorry to interrupt you, are very scared of making mistakes. They have been brought up in a culture where they're told, oh, you know, if you break off a tooth root in a tooth, oh, that's it, you're done for, you're gone, you know. The worst that we got was when we got through fifth year of dental school and we went to Raymond Begg's house in Adelaide and sat on the floor while he smoked his cigars to do light wire orthodontics. When we went back to dental school, the head of the ortho department said, oh, but you shouldn't be doing orthodontics. I mean, that's what I mean. It was just a counterculture. It's ridiculous. You come out of dental school scared to death.
Yeah, there's definitely a certain sentiment of fear of failure or fear of mistakes and fear of litigation, I guess, as well, which is something that is changing a little bit. Let's take a bit of a step back, Harry. You said you're the son of immigrant parents who survived the Holocaust. How did you find yourself into dentistry? What gave you that drive to do what you've done in dentistry as well?
Yeah, well, that's another good question. Look, this will sound comical, but this is how it was. My parents just said this to me. I mean, they didn't have an education, you know. Like high school or primary school, I worked my bum off because mum and dad would say to me, look, you know, we're immigrants, we got nothing. She said, if you don't get an education and get yourself a decent job, and I'm sorry to have to say it, they say you'll be picking chicken poo on the streets of Adelaide. That's the only job you'll get. I was particularly scared of chickens in my youth, so I didn't want to do that. So mum and dad said, you know, basically in Europe before the war, if you're a doctor, you're a somebody. If you're a lawyer, you're also a somebody. If you're a dentist, you were somebody, but everybody was scared of you. Basically, mum and dad basically said you only had three choices, you know, or four really if you wanted to be a chicken poop collector, sit on your bum and not study. So it had to be either medicine, dentistry or law. Now, at high school, I was a particularly good debater, and so the head of legal studies said you should go into law, but I couldn't think of anything worse. I didn't really enjoy, you know, working with my hands, but I was sort of was particularly good at it in the woodworking class, which is kind of funny because woodworking class was actually at my particular high school was for those kids who weren't all that bright. But somehow I ended up in that class. I'm not sure how.
I quite enjoyed woodwork as well, Harry, so I think that's fair.
There you go. Yeah, I made some beautiful inlaid biscuit trays that never got used. With me was that one day I got taken to the dentist by my mother and they um, they managed to scare the living poop out of me. They basically extracted three or four or five of my baby teeth. And I went home bleeding to death and went back to see the next day. I don't exactly know why. And he was a guy that hardly spoke. His name was Graham Pater. And when he worked on it, he just said, the whole time, right? But in the next room, there was this bloke that was working with fire and water and steam, and things were being thrown around. He was casting gold with a hand cast. I thought, that must be the dentist. I thought, that looks like fun, right? So I used to go into his place on a Thursday afternoon, and I'd burn my fingers, you know, melting wax, and I'd burn teeth by the time I was 12. And so it was a natural progression. But the funny thing was that on the day that I finished high school and we were meant to go into the University of Adelaide and sign up for whatever faculty we wanted, I went out with a few of my mates from high school. We went to the Botanical Hotel and we had a little bit too much to drink. We wandered down North Terrace to Booth Hall where we were meant to sign up. And I actually ended up signing up for dentistry because I wanted to go into medicine. Stood in the wrong queue, I was so inebriated. So I signed up for dentistry and about a week later I got a letter saying you've been accepted. So I thought, oh, well, it must be.
It's fate.
So it was fate, yeah. No, look, I always wanted to do it. You know, I had it in the back of my mind it was going to be medicine or dentistry, but for comical reasons. And then dentistry just sort of appealed and I sort of got into it a bit and that was a thing. The thing that with me, though, was that I after the first 2 years doing dentistry, I sort of somehow realised I didn't particularly like it. And so I made a decision. I made two very bad decisions. I went and started a master's degree in endodontics at the Royal Melbourne Hospital, Dental Hospital. That was an intelligent move. Stuck that out for 2 years, didn't particularly enjoy that. And then I thought, well, that's it. I'm going to go and start a practice. So I went and bought practice in the worst street from the worst person and just started work and thought, right, what I'll do is I'll build up a big business, I'll have other people working there and I'll manage it because I really enjoy working with people and managing things. Yeah, so the management side of it really was where I wanted to be because I just enjoyed working with people and coming up with ideas and being innovative and being entrepreneurial. That's always been my way.
I think it's quite insightful of you to recognize so early on that you wanted to run this as a business as opposed to just buying yourself a practice or buying yourself a job. How did you realize that you're in endo and you decided you didn't want it? You just got sick of it and decided to leave or?
Oh, mate, working at the Royal Melbourne Hospital doing endo back in the 70s, just awful because you were assigned to the conservative dentistry department. Now, the head of conservative dentistry in those days was a very unpleasant fellow called Elston Story. He was not a nice man. And the head of endo was this lovely, gorgeous little Swedish woman called Asya Vernex. And Asya would talk like this, you know, it's very nice, lady. You know, we'll be speaking soon. You must understand that the most important thing is to do your written essays. We spent so much time writing technical jargon and written essays we hardly ever did in the endo. And then to make matters worse, Elson Story had me working on his pet project, you know, caries in rat's teeth on weekends where I'd get bitten on the hands by rats all weekend. Well, yeah, you quickly get sick. So that's one thing led to another. So I stuck it out for 2 years. And that's where I sort of got my first taste of helping students because one of the jobs you had to do 3 days a week was work in the conservative dentistry department mentoring dentists, right, with their conservative work. So I really like the students, and a lot of those students are still friends of mine today. They all have their own practices, and in fact, I had dinner with one of them last night, and we sort of reminisced about that. So it was just the fact that I didn't enjoy the research, which was just jargon and nonsense, and really there was no actual teaching of endodontics. It was all these research projects and research and research and research, and then they said to me, "What are you going to do your thesis on?" And back in those days, they just invented some device that you could use. It was the first stage of the first root canal apex finder, beeping. Yes. And so I decided I'd do a project on the auditory differences between different operators using root canal apex finders.
That's really sold me on specialist endodontics.
Yeah, yeah. A critical element of research in the world of dentistry.
Certainly critical. So you found So you found yourself out of that, having some experience in some abstract things, I guess, and then into private practice, owning your own practice. Why did you buy?
Well, I'd been working for three dentists, one in Collins Street, a lovely man, Dr. Ron Perdue, who was really very nice to me. Then I worked for a couple of other dentists who I don't want to mention who were not particularly nice to me. When I went in there, the practices were doing very poorly, and by the end of the year I built one practice up to three times the turnover, four, and this particular dentist didn't appreciate what I'd done and he was a bit rude to me. And at that stage I thought, no, this is it. I can't do this anymore. I've got to get my own place. So I thought, I'll go out and find something. So I went through all the dental houses as you did in those days. I went through a lovely old fellow called David Neary, who was at Flavelle's Glanfield, another dental company that bit the dust a few years ago. And he said, oh, look, he said, a young fellow like you is not going to be able to buy much. I said, well, just show me what you got. And he took me out to this practice in East Bentley, which was run by a lovely old man called Dr. Gajiro. And I walked in there and the conversation went like this. He had a waiting room full of people, right? There was about 30 or 40 people, some of them standing. All he was doing was $1 extractions, $3 amalgam fillings and dentures for $30. That was his whole practice, right? So I looked at it and David said, you want to buy it? I said, how much does he want for it? I said, he wants $11,000. I said, I haven't got that much money. He said, well, and then the dentist heard that and he came out and he said, if you haven't got that much money, he said, you better get out of here. I said, what are you going to do if you don't get a buyer? I mean, because it was a horrible practice. He said, well, I don't get a buyer yet, Sonny Jim. He said, lock the door on the 24th of December, throw the key in the gutter and walk away. I said, oh, that's good. He said, I'll be sitting in the gutter waiting. He said, oh, you're a smart aleck, eh? The price just went up to $13,500.
Did you pay that?
So I thought, I did. Oh, I went to the bank. They wouldn't lend me the money. I had to tell them a really phony baloney story that I'd pay it back within, you know, so much time. Finally, they gave me the money and I went back to him and I just handed him a check. I'm not kidding. He was in the middle of an extraction. He put his forceps down, wiped all the blood off his hands, took off his gown and said, it's all yours now, Sonny Jim, and walked out.
Wow. So
he walked down the stairs.
So you started straight away, huh?
Started extracting teeth. And then I learned the first painful lesson. When you look into a business, look into it properly. He didn't tell me that he was a good Catholic man. Over 80% of the practice were Catholic nuns, priests, and various ministers who, wait for it, did not pay a cent for their dentistry, not a penny. So the next patient after I'd finished that extraction was someone from one of the Catholic schools. And I said to him, that'll be $30. He said, no, you don't understand. We don't pay here. And then when I looked through the books, I found that the vast majority of the patients weren't paying anything. He was just working for nothing, right? So I closed the practice for 2 weeks. I gutted the whole place, put in carpet and lino and tiles and sterilizers and x-ray machines and a new chair and a compressor and a sucker motor and cancelled all the patients and rebooked them, you know, in half-hour visits, et cetera. And anybody that came in, I said, look, I'm charging for it because I've got to feed myself and clothe myself and pay the rent. Lost about 80% of the practice, but I wasn't deterred. I just said, right, that's it. Now I'll just start rebuilding. And by the end of the first year, I was back. I'd built the place up to $323,000 worth of turnover, which was amazing. Working like a Trojan, I was doing 7 days a week, 10 and 12 hours a day. Bit tough with only two staff. But then I thought, okay, got to buy another chair. So I bought another chair. And I went out and hired myself a dentist from Adelaide and I put them on time and I said, no, I said, you need to work full-time. And I said, oh, no, we don't want to work full-time. We've got a really cushy job at the school dental service. We don't want to work full-time. We're happy just working part-time. I said, no. I said, I need someone to help me out. So anyway, this first dentist said, all right, well, look, I'll help you out. I'll come and work for you. Well, he ended up staying 12 years and then I hired another dentist and another dentist. By the end of the third year, I had four dentists working and I'd expanded the building into twice the size that it had been.
So, right? Harry, I think in hindsight, the answer to this is pretty obvious, but I want to ask, was that the right decision for you at the time? And is that something that you recommend others to go into, practice ownership early on?
No, it was the right decision for me, but I would not recommend it today. The right thing to do today if they're a young dentist coming out of school, is to get a good apprenticeship somewhere for 2 or 3 years with a respectable dentist who will teach him all the ropes, right? Because today we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of one-chair practices around this country operating by dentists sitting there with sad eyes and wringing their hands saying, what am I going to do for some work? How am I going to pay my bills? I wouldn't recommend buying a practice, and I certainly wouldn't recommend starting a practice anywhere nowadays, because there are so many new startups by these young people, it's ridiculous, and they're all closing one by one because they can't sustain them. So my recommendation is get a job somewhere with someone who will teach you the ropes, stay there 3 or 4 years, then if you think you know what you're doing, then go and start your own practice.
And if you are going to start or purchase your own practice, what path do you recommend? What kind of things do they need to learn first?
I recommend three things. Number one, the first thing you need to do if you're going to start a practice somewhere is go to the local council and get all the demographics. Understand the social economy of the place. Understand what the local wage is. Are they blue-collar workers, white-collar workers? Are there schools there? What level of schools are there? Is there a big predominance of people with health insurance? Are there people with no health insurance? You know, you need to know, is there public transport? All those sorts of things. The second thing you need to know is, do you have the ability to talk to people? And when I got out of dental school is I spent 2 years part-time going to acting classes, David. That's right. You heard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I wanted to know, how do you speak to people? The other thing I did, I used to go into David Jones on a Saturday morning and sit in the makeup department and listen to these little old ladies with the blue hair selling hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of useless makeup to people on the premise that it'll change their lives and make them look good. So at least I got to learn how to talk to people about buying stuff that they didn't want, right? And that's important because in dentistry, you're a retailer. You are selling things, right? You're selling things. Yes, you're doing a service, but you're basically providing things to people. So you need to learn how to sell things.
I think it's important to be able to convey your recommendations in a way that let the patient understand how their situation is and let them make the right decision. If we're not communicating well, then patients will be leading themselves down the wrong path.
Correct. And last of all, when you do start up your practice, make sure you start it up in an area that's got a potential for growth. So go and find a growth corridor from whatever place you live in and try and forecast where that's going to go. And most of all, read extensively. Always read. Read everything. Read every newspaper you can lay your hands on. Study the economy. Study health. Read the Scientific American. Read Time Magazine. Read Newsweek. Read The Economist. Read and read and read and get a feel for what's going on out there in the community. Don't bury your head in the sand and say, well, I do the best damn Cerex for miles around because nobody.
It's so true, and it's a great advice to keep yourself educated in all aspects, especially if you're in business. Economy is so important. Early on, you said there wasn't much mentorship around. There wasn't many people to ask. Did you end up finding yourself some good mentors?
In the end, I did, and I'll tell you who they were because I'm very proud of knowing these men. Unfortunately, none of them are no longer alive. The first mentor I found was a wonderful man called David Howell. He was the director of dentistry and chiropractic in Iowa in the United States, and I met him quite by accident because I was over in the United States learning to do fixed-band orthodontics, and he was there lecturing on something or other, I can't remember what. And he said, do you understand much about occlusion? I said, I know nothing about it. Why don't you come to Iowa and I'll show you how we teach the dentists about chiropractic. I said, what? Chiropractic? Isn't that voodoo? Or he said, see, you think it's mumbo jumbo. So he took me under his wing and started teaching me the connection between the oral cavity, the neck, the back, the shoulder, the feet, something I'm so grateful for because it just changed the way I view dentistry. And it gave me an opportunity to help people not just with their teeth but with their posture, with their headaches, with their way they felt. That was number one. Number two was an incredible man called Rick Stoddard. Rick Stoddard was professor of periodontics in the Twin Cities, in Twin Cities in the United States. And what did he teach me? He taught me something that had nothing to do with the actual practice of dentistry, but he told me what HMOs and PPOs were, in other words, preferred provider organizations, about 20 years before it ever came to Australia. And he was good enough to take me under his wing, Rick Stallard, and show me how this could be applied to a private practice in Australia. That was, simply put, and in other words, amazing. He was just incredible. And last but not least was a lovely fella in Chicago,
That's okay.
And what he said to me was, he said, you need to understand how you grow a practice. I said, what? And I spent 6 weeks with him in Chicago, the best 6 weeks of my life, understanding how you absolutely set up, run, maintain, finance, grow, scale, upscale and leverage a dental practice business. That was just incredible. So those three men stuck with me for as long as they were alive. I was always able to call on them and ask them for advice. But sadly, they all unfortunately passed away. Only one of them actually died from natural causes. The other two, they couldn't face a lot of things, and as a result of that, they took their own life.
It's very hard to hear these stories, Harry, and I think as much as it is hard for us to hear, and of course, I'm sorry to hear that your friends have been lost in that way. I think it's also important we do hear it because it's something that we need to be vigilant about and reach out to the right people. How did you find these people? How did you meet them?
You know, that's the funny thing, David. Everything that's happened to me, and I mean everything that's happened to me in my personal life, in my business life, has all happened completely and utterly by chance. I kid you not. I kid you not. Absolutely by chance. Look, I'm a friendly person. I will go and talk to people if they've got an interesting face, right? I just go and say hello to them. I mean, 6 weeks ago I was walking down the beach at Phillip Island and I saw this fellow walking towards me and my wife was me. I said, gee, that guy looks interesting. He said, leave him alone. And he was walking along, humming along. I said, g'day, Barry, how are you? He said, did you recognise me? I said, yeah, I did. He said, is this about the money? And I got straight into it, you know, because I love acting. I said, yeah, mate, it is.
Acting lessons came through.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He said, is this about Trevor? I said, yes, mate. He said, he wants to know what's happening with the money. He said, listen, he said, you got to tell him. He said, I'm really sorry. He said, I know he wants the money back. Promise me, mate, go and see him now. I'm good for it. Tell him not to send anybody after me. I promise you, I'm good for it. I'll give you the money back. Just tell him not to do anything. I said, okay, mate. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it. And I'll go and talk to him. And I started to walk away. And my wife said, who was it? I said, I have no idea. I've never seen him before. Oh, gee. So I just talk to people. You know, I see people and I think people look interesting. And I'm not kidding. 99% of the time, the people that I've met that have been important in my life, I've met quite by accident.
That said, you would have been in the States looking for education. So I guess it's by chance, but you put yourself in the right places.
I spent a lot of my time there. I spent a lot of time in England. I was at the East End Hospital doing Edgewise Orthodontics. I met some amazing men there who taught me sedation and general anesthesia and, again, practice management techniques. One of the most bizarre meeting of all was in Chicago at the midwinter meeting, and I saw these three guys, you know, walking around having a jolly old time, and they were all wearing these sort of check jackets with funny hats on. I said, who are you guys? They said, we're the guys from 100 Dental in Toronto. You want to come with us and have a good time? I said, yep, count me in, right? So these three guys were absolutely as high could be. They'd all been on LSD. They're all dentists, and they're just wandering around just partying. You know, they weren't even looking at the exhibits or anything. I end up at their hotel, and we're talking, you know, I've calmed down a little bit, and these guys have got a 100 chair, I kid you not, a 100-chair facility in Montreal. Kidding me. He said, no, we run this amazing corporation, and it was actually called, Titan 100. It had an amazing name. So have a look at it. I could not believe my eyes. This place was running like a well-oiled machine, you know, hundreds of people running around. They had turnovers in the millions of dollars, and those blokes said to me, this is what you need to do in Australia. And I came back and I set about doing exactly that, which led to my first ever retail dental practice in a retail store in the middle of Collins Street, which went from zero to $338,000 in turnover in the first year, just applying the principles that these three cuckamongers showed me as a captain in Chicago.
That's incredible. It's incredible where you pick up these skills over time, and I guess it is about meeting the right people, and sometimes it is by chance.
It's always that. You know, you can go and look and seek and look up magazines and go to courses, but when you meet people who are just real people, you know, and they are real in every sense of the word, and they have really achieved and really done things. I mean, I met one of the two ICs at McDonald's, you know, on an aeroplane. And he said to me, if you really want to learn retailing, he said, come and work in my store. So I was a hamburger flipjack for about 6 weeks, you know, just to learn how to retail hamburgers. It was amazing, the lessons I learned. I got to meet Frank Lowy, you know, and spoke to him, man. Another holiday.
Yeah.
He told me about his success with retailing and stores. I met that amazing guy in Sydney. He used to smoke cigars. He was very big on the stock market, but unfortunately killed himself. He was a man impressive. He was in Double Bay. Anyway, I met him by chance, and he talked about the stock market. I met a guy in geological research one day playing tennis, and he started teaching me about how you leverage shares and money, and then you can buy the practices. And then from there I started buying other dental practices. Not such a good idea, but.
Tell us about that. It's a bad word, but failure, if you say it wasn't a good idea, perhaps it wasn't the direction for you. Tell us about that. It's good to hear something.
I'm going to tell you. Let's call it a spade a spade. The first one I bought was actually quite okay. It was in Ormond Road, Elwood. There was a lady there called Mrs. Thompson. I knew her husband, Reginald Thompson. He was a nice guy, dentist, worked on his own, one-chair practice, you know, the same old thing, stringy white hair, bent over at the back, bad back, still standing up. And she rang me up and she said, Reg is not very well. I don't know how I'm going to manage the practice. Could you come and run the practice for me, because I won't have any money and I can't take care of Reg. Mm. So as I went down to Elwood, I put another dentist in my place. So suddenly I learned how to hire people and get them to work for me, right? Out of necessity to help somebody else, right? So I went down to Elwood 2 days a week and I worked in the practice, and she said, oh, you can keep the money. I said, no. I said, Elaine, I'm here helping you. You keep the money. You can pay me, you know, a percentage for seeing the patients, but, you know, it's not fair. You need the money to look after yourself. And she said, oh, you're such a nice man. She said, if Reginald doesn't get better, he said, you can take over the practice. I said, no, Reginald will be better. Well, Reginald died the next day.
Yes.
Next thing I know, you know, I'm running a practice that I just sort of didn't really want or need. You know? So very quickly you learn how to make things work. You know, you've got to go on, now you've got to get another nurse, now you've got to find another dentist, you've got to find someone who knows what he's doing. That was the first one. The second one I bought was in Brunswick in Victoria. Now, that was another big mistake. I went in there to that practice with a well-known dentist here in Victoria who ended up being a bit of a con artist, the lovely Noel Campbell. He's the fellow who goes down in history as the first person to ever use ozone gas intraanally to cure a toothache. So that didn't work. It was just a nightmare trying to get involved. I got out of that pretty quickly. Mm. And then I bought a practice in Hawthorne, a one-man practice. Again, bad move, wrong staff, wrong attitude, wrong place, wrong time. You know, ran it for 2 years, had a big turnover, didn't make any profit. And then the only one that really worked well for me is when I started a practice from scratch.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely scratch in the city. A retail practice in the middle of the city in a retail building, and I was the first dentist in Victoria, if not in Australia, to legally advertise dental services in a private practice, and that got me going. So I learned how you go that. And I did that by starting what was known as a friendly society.
Oh, yes.
Friendly society. Were allowed to advertise, like Mutual Benefit or Manchester Unity or Australian Unity. So I just started my own because I thought, if they can advertise, why can't I? So I did, and that's how that practice got going, and it was an absolute boomer. I kept it for 12 years. I sold it for a big profit and sold it to the guy that was working for me. When I sold it to him, there were 5 dentists working there. Within 2 years, it was down to 1.
Wow, that's a big change. What happened there?
He didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
You know, he was a nice guy, a good dentist, but he had no marketing skills. He didn't know how to talk to people. He was very good technically, didn't perform to people.
That's a challenge. You know, Harry, what did you learn from your experiences of purchasing or ending up in each of these practices?
I learned that you've got to do your homework. You know, you don't just think. I had a dentist call me today, you know, and he's in Sydney and he wants to start a practice in miles away, you know, in Unicalabi. I said, "Why is it?" You know, he said, "Oh, I'm not busy enough." He said, "So what are you going to do? Spread yourself even thinner, so it'll be even less busy." So what I learned was, you do your research. You don't just buy a practice and think you'll hang up a shingle. Those days are over, right? You only buy a practice if you think you've got the right marketing and entrepreneurial skills, because if you haven't, don't do it. You will burn in hell. What I learned was, do your research, do your sociological research, do your demographic research, do your financial research, research everything. It's business you're running. You're not there to make people happy with nice crowns and Cerex. You are running a business. If you're not going to run a business, don't get involved, and don't buy practices for the whim of it. You know, I mean, these guys that are running around buying these two-bit practices all over the place and saying, well, gee, why aren't I busy? There's no great skill. It's crazy. Just don't do it.
I think it's an important thing to hear, that buying and running and having a practice is not an easy thing to do if you don't have those certain skills that are business skills, not dentistry skills, and we don't get taught that in any other way. So unless you're going to go out and learn all these things, it's a challenge. I want to make a point, we're not here to talk too much about business because it's mostly for graduates and students, but
sure,
you started, well, your first practice was actually East Bentley, and now it's East Bentley Dental Group, and you have, I think it's 17 dentists, and you're very successful in a single location. Why did you go from multiple to single?
Oh, very simply, mate. One set of overheads, one place to control, very simple. I actually have the practice I've got now is 1.5 times bigger than the 6 practices I used to own. And it's in one location, one set of overheads, one set of headaches, one set of staff, one rental. You get the picture?
Absolutely. No, that sounds, it makes a lot of sense.
And the people that are running around, and there are some men that I'm friendly with who are running around saying, yeah, look, I've got 6, I've got 9, I've got 10, I've got 12. Mate, I've been there. You cannot tell me that you can just have 6 practices in 6 different locations with 6 sets of overheads and that it's profitable. It just can't be. I've been there. I've done it. It just isn't. And I'm not stupid.
Yeah, it makes sense to focus your energy into one place. But I'm definitely no business expert. So let's actually hop back to a lot of what you do for others. And I've heard you referred to as Dr. Call Me. You often put your number on. When someone's asking a question, you just say, "Call me now."
Yeah.
Why do you do that? Or more, I guess we've asked that. Do you put time aside for this, or do you just do it?
I do, and I don't. When I see these questions, I can see the panic in these questions. So I say, just call me. There are reasons for that. One, I hate typing. I hate typing, and I hate texting even more, right? So I'd rather talk to somebody than text them, because I can't text to save my life. B, I can't type to save my life. And the spoken word is far better than the texted word. You speak, people hear you, they understand. You text, they say, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think having that connection with someone when they are stressed, you can really understand how they feel, and you can probably get through a lot better as well.
It's funny, because some of my existing clients say, you know, it's so nice that you've got this, just call me and you'll help me out. And one of them said, why do you do that? It's so funny, because the millennials don't get it.
Yeah, they think, yeah. You know,
texting is what we do, but, you know, us dinosaurs, we talk.
Well, it's funny, because I tend to lean towards text. You may have noticed that, Harry, when I organise this podcast.
Yeah,
with you.
That's okay.
But I've got.
That's okay, mate. You're a young man. You have that on your side.
We got through. We organised it. I've got a few friends where they're very much call. So you text them because you're in a hurry and you don't have time to call, and they'll call you back no matter what. And you just learn to call those people, and that's okay as well. So through all your mentoring of many different people and different people in different stages of their career, I want to know a little bit about what you hear the problems being for the younger people. So say the graduates.
Okay. I think we can divide them up into several groups. The obvious one is set up and maintenance. So a lot of them, if they buy an existing practice, they tend to go in blind, buy an existing practice with old chairs, old equipment, old compressors, old everything, and don't even realize what they're getting into. That's step number two. They usually don't have any concept of costs and profit and loss. As I've already alluded to, their technical skill set is usually badly wanting. And four, they tend to borrow money on credit cards and other facilities that they simply can't afford and really shouldn't do. First instance, there's a lot of very poor planning. I was at a practice about 3 months ago, which is on the main road opposite the casino in Melbourne, where the traffic flow is horrendous and there's not a traffic island anywhere. There are no traffic lights. The traffic is just zooming up and down this main road. Somebody has opened up a practice under a bridge in a darkened building opposite the casino exit car park. The wife rang me up and said, could you come in and have a look at our practice? And I couldn't even find it in the first place. And I had a look and I thought, gee, this is tough. She said, we're not very busy. I said, does anybody know you're here? She said, yeah, the owner of the building won't let us put a sign outside. I said, well, how are you going to find it? And, you know, that's another thing, location.
Yeah, definitely, parking and accessibility.
Yeah, and then I went to a practice yesterday. This is a funny one. So this girl rings me up. She says, well, can you come out and have a look at us? She said, I'm really struggling with the people that own the building and everything else. I'm not getting anywhere. I said, well, all right. So I got the address and I drove out. And for the life of me, I'd driven up and down this street with the address. I could not find it. I stopped the car and I got out and I started walking. And I see this young woman walking towards me with a handbag, looking a bit frustrated. She said, you can't find the surgery, can you? I said, no. She said, there it is in front of you. And I turned around and in front of me was, I'm not kidding, a building set back from the street with iron shutters around every small glass doorway, right? But everything else was shuttered with iron shutters. And I said, that's the surgery? She said, yeah. I said, what's iron shutters? She said, we get a lot of thievery and break-ins around here. All right. I said, what's this shipping container doing here on the street outside? And she said, that's my problem. I said, well, what is it? She said, have a look. And I had a look on the side and it said, kebabs after 3 o'clock. Dumped a shipping container that's converted into a kitchen kebab shop in front of the only exit entrance to the dental surgery and medical center there. I mean, I ask you, how's that working for us? She said, well, that's the problem. I want to get out of here, but I signed this lease before they put this kebab shop in front of my entrance. Now I don't want to be here anymore. And she said, come in and see the toilets. I said, no, thanks. What have I learned? What do I learn every day? Plenty. Since starting this, I have seen some situations that defy logic and the imagination. I'm not kidding. I've seen things that would make you cry.
It's really interesting to hear this. And I guess what you're trying to say is do your research before you end up in this situation, because once you're in that situation, I guess it's pretty hard to get out.
And get advice. Get advice. You know, if you don't know what you're doing, call me. I'll talk to you. I'll help you out. I'll come out and have a look. I'll get you started. I'll keep you out of trouble. Yeah.
Doctor, call me. Apart from yourself, and I think it is important that people understand you're genuine with that and you do want to help people, are there any other avenues or things you see where people should be reaching out, or any, courses or anything that people should be doing before they're getting into business?
Look, I think there are a plethora of courses out there from a number of men. The problem that I found, and you may have heard from people, that I don't charge for my time, okay? I do charge. I think I'm the only one that doesn't. There are a lot of people, a lot of good men out there running really good courses, and women. You know, I can mention names. They all know who they are because we all sort of hang out together and talk to one another. Is that a lot of these courses are so expensive, you know, $2,000 and $3,000 a day, and they are what I call cookbook courses. One of them, which isn't, is the course Prime. You know, Prime do a wonderful program, which is, you know, tailored for the individual, right? So that's a good one. Look, there are others. All the men and women know who they are. They don't need me to mention their names. They know who they are. There are some good courses. The problem is they're so expensive. And the courses seem to be just a cookbook slap up, you know, sort of approach to doing things, one size fits all. What I do is that I found is you've got to go and talk to them individually. No two practices are the same. And more importantly, no two principles are the same. That's what I found. So there are other courses. There are some other programs, but I think what are the dentists are finding, and I've heard this, and I don't want to criticise anybody, that a few people have been to some of the more flashy names in this industry and just said, well, you know, I didn't get anything out of it.
It's, I guess, with courses, some can be very good and some not as good, and it's a hard thing for us to learn as we graduate that we're spending a lot of money on courses and sometimes they don't quite meet the target. I do want to say, and I'm not even sure if you know this, Harry, but we're supported by Prime Practice. So they are in affiliation with us, but I did not pay Harry to say that. Neither did Prime.
Well, look, I know the boys at Prime and all of them are great guys and they know what they're doing and they've done the hard yard, so to speak. Right?
They've been around a while, yeah.
There are other men doing things. You know, there are other men and women doing things. Look, they create a good message. What I've found is that people that have come to me have been to them and said, look, I just didn't quite get it. It was a nice – I sort of got what he was about, but it seemed to be pretty much – all the same. So if there's a room of 20 or 30 people, you know, you can't give them all the same message. You've got to tailor it to them.
Certainly makes sense. It's like doing dentistry. It all depends on the patient, not us.
Sure.
It's not cookie cutter. I want to change topic a bit. You talk about a lot in the forums and things. I've seen you do some live Facebook things and I've seen you talk about things like fear and self-belief and other more personal things or personal growth, if we could call it that. Are you quite interested in personal development? Do you think it's something that people need to focus on as well?
It is the most important thing you can do for yourself and your family. The most singly important thing. After the war, both my parents suffered terribly with all various forms of depression. You can imagine being in a concentration camp wasn't the greatest thing for a young woman or a young man.
No, I can imagine.
Coming out of that as a young person, watching my parents crying in the corner of the room in the middle of the night and being fearful of people walking in or sirens going or ambulances going up and down the street and being fearful and always being fearful, I found that I learned very quickly that I had to do something to build myself up from the inside out. So self-belief, absolutely, because fear was the one thing that will kill you in your success as a dentist and as a business person. So I found that I had to do a lot of courses, and I did courses like, for example, in the early 1970s, I did a course called Getting in Touch with Your Feminine Side, right? Now, why'd I do that? Because I'd learned very quickly that there were other people in this world called girls. So self-belief, critical. Fear, a big problem, and the fear is what I see and I hear when I go into these small practices with these young dentists. Not only are they fearful, but their staff are fearful. You know, one of the practices in the western suburbs of Sydney said to me, geez, we really hope you come back soon, Harry, because without you here, she doesn't know what she's doing, right? So there is a lot of and personal belief and self-personal belief and the hypnosis course, that taught me a lot. The acting course taught me a lot. I spent a lot of time in the law courts listening to barristers and judges talking to learn how to stand up in front of a crowd. I did the Lions Youth of the Year talking contest. I learned how to be a speaker. I spent a lot of time learning debating. In fact, I debated for university and continued after I graduated. So all of these skills you need to have under your belt to be successful in life, not just in business or in dentistry, but in life. Belief and firm self-belief are very important. So I took that through to another level with my tennis. So I wasn't a particularly good tennis player, but I learned very quickly that if you wanted to enjoy your tennis, you had to become great. So I would go and watch people play tennis and I just nudge them a bit and say, could you show me how to serve a ball like that? And I found that that also was a way of acquiring these skills. But probably the single most amazing thing that I've ever been able to do was when I met a man called Martin Blakey. Martin Blakey was a mathematician who taught at Elwood High School. Martin Blakey was a giant of a man. Martin was in the top 1-2% of Mensa. He was so smart, so bright. He could do massive mathematical calculations in his head. But Martin also loved life, and he had a wicked spirit to him. But Martin also enjoyed going to the casino. He knew nothing about casinos. Martin took me into the casino, and he started to teach me how you played blackjack to win money, not to gamble, but to win, to go in and actually win money. And he said, you can be a gambler if you like, but he said, if you want to have a nice life, he said, you have to learn how to win money. Now, what did Martin teach me? He showed me that, but then he really showed me something quite interesting. He showed me how to win at a game that I thought no one won at, called roulette. Now, I'm not talking to you now about gambling because I'm against gambling, but I tell you what Martin showed me. Martin showed me how mathematically, keeping things in your head, you could approach risk and fear differently. Martin taught me how to walk on hot coals because he said, look, when you walk up to the roulette table, you've got to study the table. You've got to study the ball, the spinner, the dealer, the people sitting at the table, where the bets are going, where the numbers are falling. And he would walk up to that table with nothing but a pen and paper. He'd stand there for 10 minutes and you'd watch his eyes darting. He was watching everything. And then after he'd watched what he needed to watch and he taught me what he was doing, he then took out some money, put it down on the table, and, of course, within about 10 minutes he'd won $3,500. Just get up and walk away. Why am I telling you this? Because I often tell people in my lectures, you know, now, to be successful in life, you've got to be prepared to take a gamble. Sometimes you have to gamble. Sometimes you have to put your money down on the table and just say, look, let's take a risk. Because if you're not a risk taker, you're not going to achieve anything. So Martin taught me how to take calculated risks in the casino, but he also showed me how to do it outside the casino. In different areas, both in life and in personal development. So risk, fear, you need to overcome, and you can overcome them in many different ways. For me, my luck was meeting Martin Blakey, and not so much for him to teach me how to be a casino gambler, because I don't love it and I don't go there purposely. I mean, if I'm killing time, I might go there for 5-10 minutes, but it's not something I can do every week nor every day, every minute. But what he taught me to do is how to approach fear. And I approach fear now differently than I ever did. And now I teach my young students how to approach fear by taking calculated risks. So one of the things you need to do going forward in dentistry is work out how to take calculated risks. And the biggest one I would do, and I talk about this quite openly, is a lot of dentists say to me, oh, well, you know, I'm going to wait till I'm busy and then I'll put on another chair, another dentist. See, I didn't do that. To do was I'd say to myself, I need to be busy, so I'm going to put on another dentist and another chair, and then I'm going to work out how to make them busy. You understand? So I go about it in the reverse direction, and most people sit there with their mouths gaping up going, you can't do that. That's too risky. And then I talk to them about risk and I talk to them about Martin Blakey. Does that make sense?
It certainly does make sense. And what you're saying is do your research and stack the risk in your favor, but you still have to take risks.
You have to take the risk. You do. There's not, because if you're not prepared to take the risk, you'll just be the same all the time. Nothing changes without change.
There's no change without change. It's beautiful.
Correct.
That's a great story. Correct. And I think that certainly has taught a lot, you know, well outside of the gambling side or the numbers side, but it's a life lesson. And I think that's fantastic.
No, he taught me a lot of other things too. I mean, his knowledge, his general knowledge, I mean, he's brilliant. I mean, I've been on 5 quiz shows now. I've been on The Chaser. I've been on Hot Seat Millionaire. I've been on Deal or No Deal. I'm about to go on with Tom Gleese. I'm going to be on.
Is it Hard or?
In a couple of weeks, Hard
yeah,
Quiz.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just taught me how to be a quiz genius as well.
I didn't know that about you, Harry. I'm so glad that came up. Yeah. Tell me, how do you win quizzes?
Well, you know, the funny thing is it's just amazing. I mean, I read a lot and I watch a lot of stuff and, you know, you read and you absorb. You know, I'm like an osmotic sponge. Everything I see I sort of take in. I don't care whether it's the size of a coin or the colour of a flag or the capital city of Babylon or whatever, you know, I just absorb stuff. But a lot of stuff you can work out in your own. Martin taught me how to think. He really taught me how to think. He said, you know, you don't think with your brain, you think with your mind and you think with your heart. And so, you know, I see questions now about, you know, what's this and that? And I go, look at it. oh, it's got to be this. And I press the button, it's usually right.
Yeah. Trusting your intuition.
Correct.
So, Harry, you've clearly had a thirst for knowledge from the very beginning, and it's certainly set you up to where you are now. You took yourself into hypnosis for a period of time, and I wanted to touch on that again. Tell me, why did you do that, and what effect did that have on your patients, your life, etc.?
Yeah. This was a very big time in my life because I was the new boy in Melbourne. You know, I'd only been in Melbourne a few months. I'd come from Adelaide. I was a kid, barely 21. But I figured that, well, look, you know, I'm a dentist now and, you know, people fear the dentist. So initially I thought, well, maybe I'll go and learn hypnosis so that I can sort of hypnotize people as you do when you're a young foolish boy and make them forget about their dental experience. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. So I thought, no, let's just investigate this. So I went along to a couple of lectures at the Royal Melbourne School, and then I thought, no, what the hell, let's jump in, let's take a risk, let's sign up. You know, paid the registration fee, and every Wednesday night for, you know, a whole year I'd go into the lecture theatre. Well, this one particular night, the third night, the doors open, we all flood in, and then the lights go down, and then one single light comes on and there's a woman standing there in a red leather miniskirt with very high heel shoes on. She's beautifully dressed, beautifully made up. She had lovely eyeshadow, earrings, long neck, but I didn't take a good look. But she was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And the room went quiet. And she started walking like they do, that sort of, you know, prancy sort of walk. And she walked straight up to me, lowered her head and looked me straight in the eyes, and she said, "Do you want me to hypnotize you?" I said, "You already have, but go for it." She was Professor Lorraine Denniston, and I was immediately in love. She became my personal mentor in the art of clinical hypnosis, and she taught me everything about hypnosis. So in the beginning, I kid you not, I thought hypnosis would be fantastic for dentistry. You could just use it to calm down patients. Is getting someone into a trance takes about an hour and a half, you know. So unless you've got nothing better to do with your day.
Seeing three patients a day.
Anyway, I stuck with it and I graduated. I got the degree, and then I was a bit naughty. I started using it at dinner parties, you know, to hypnotize them. So what is hypnosis? Hypnosis at the end of the day, my dear friend, is nothing more than me suggesting to you something that you may or may not want to do, right? Hypnosis at its very basics is, hey, David, would you like to enjoy a really nice cup of coffee and a beautiful escargot bun and do that on every night with no consequences to your weight or your heart? Sure, right? So hypnosis is about coming up with an idea that the hypnotee, the victim that you're working on, is going, yeah, that's a good idea. For the first 2 years, I would just use my hypnosis skills very naughtily, because you sign a document saying you won't do it, at dinner parties and cocktail parties at my house, resulting in many, many people ending up on the floor in a trance at my house till 4 o'clock in the morning. Because I was already out to it, I couldn't remember how to wake them up. And then I woke them up and they all said, gee, that was pretty cool. Look, I think hypnosis is a wonderful thing to learn, but you're never going to use it commercially in dentistry. But what it's good for is your own personal development and your self-satisfaction and how you manage your life, because when you're really up against it and things are going bad, hypnosis or self-hypnosis, which I prefer to call it, you can use to your advantage. It becomes a wonderful
tool. How would you go about that? Is it about calming yourself and going through, conversation with yourself, or how do you do it?
Yeah. Well, essentially, you use the same basic skills. See, I'm a particularly susceptible person to suggestion. So I'm able to sort of go into a quiet place, close my eyes, focus my breathing, concentrate your breathing on a certain area, slow your breathing right down, and then you just start repeating certain thoughts in your mind, and you close your mind to everything else except the sound of your own breathing. And then once you hear that, You start to put a suggestion in your mind, and that suggestion starts to take its own shape and its own form. And I'm doing it right now to myself. I'm actually imagining a light beam from the ceiling above my head, going through my head, through my body, right to the floor, connecting me to Mother Earth. And now I just feel this complete relaxation coming over all of my body. My arms and my legs are starting to go a little bit limp, and I'm feeling very relaxed. That's how you do it.
It's an interesting tool, and it's very similar in ways to different types of meditation. And I think it's something that, obviously, I've got no experience or professional, nothing to do with this, but it sounds like something that's pretty useful if you're anxious and stressed in dentistry.
It's amazing. I mean, I use it periodically with some of my students because they do get themselves into a bind, and it's a terrific skill to have. And I can refer you to a wonderful textbook by Erickson if you do get a chance. Erickson, the self of hypnosis. Have a look at it. You'll enjoy it.
I'll put that in the show notes. That's something that some people will definitely want to see. Harry, let's wrap this up. Now, I like to ask a couple of questions that I want to aim pretty focused on graduates and students. And the first one, I want you to think back to yourself in that time where you did graduate. You had a little bit of anxiety. You ended up going to practice pretty early as well. What advice would you now give to yourself that would help you either get to where you are faster or better or more successful? What would you tell yourself?
My advice to myself would be acquire a mentor, a good one, pay them well, and learn everything you can from them for as long as it takes. So pay someone, you know, instead of wasting those 2 years, have 2 years of mentoring from an excellent mentor, number one. Number two, read around your profession. So read about taking care of people. Read about other things that you can do for people immensely. Learn about risk. Learn to manage risk and learn not to be fearful. Take care of your health. Stay on the right side of your diet. You know, don't get involved in stupidity like I did when I was younger with, you know, where we did all these sorts of crazy things because the 70s were about free love and then we did some pretty crazy stuff. But mainly just get a good mentor and work with someone and study them night and day, day and night, and learn their methods, learn how they speak, learn how they handle themselves, learn how they walk, how they talk, you know, get a feeling for who they are and what they are. Yeah.
And that's great advice. There's so much we can learn from someone else who's further down the track than we already are. I'd like to ask a second question, and it is very similar, but this one I want you to think about everyone who is actually graduating now. In fact, they'll be graduating fairly soon. And imagine you can teach them one skill or tell them one thing. What would it be that you would tell every student now?
The one thing that I'd tell them, listen to your heart first. Don't think that you're now a dentist, that you know everything and that you're gonna take on the world. Listen to your heart. But before you listen to your heart, listen to some people around you who are giving you good advice about where and what to learn and what to do. Don't jump in head first. Go look, learn. You've still got 2 years. Learn as much as you can now. Acquire knowledge. Become a sponge. Don't start saying, well, I'm going to do the best class two crown. Work out how you can talk to people and how people will listen to you. Acquire people skills. Become a person is what I'm talking about, because you've got the dental skills. Now you need to learn the people skills. And that can only be got from going to the right people. I mean, look what I did. Acting school, I went to courses on improving yourself. I read every book I could lay my hands on improving myself. And then work on your fitness as well. Keep your health, right?
I think all of those are fantastic points. I like, one, keep your health. That's so important. Also, it's a bit meditative and another way of stress relieving. But I like what you said about reading outside of dentistry and, you know, getting tips and bits outside of that torrent of dental information that we see on social media. Because although that is very, I think it's helpful and we can see a lot of amazing work and learn a lot, but we only learn that channel. So broaden your scope and you'll definitely get a lot more.
Broaden scope. That's a good one. Yeah, broaden the scope, because that's the key. Broaden, go beyond what you learned at dental school. That's just That's just the microcosm of the world, you know. It's not what you really need to know. What you really need to know is people, how to relate to people, how to interact with people. That's
fantastic, Harry, and I genuinely and really appreciate your time. We've spent over an hour chatting now, and it's been a lot of great information and a great story.
Oh, David, you're very welcome. I've got much more for you.
Well, Harry, perhaps we'll be doing round two, and I really do look forward to that. I actually look forward to meeting you one day. Thank you, Harry, Margaret, for your time. Graduation from dental school is such a high, it's a great time in your life, but transitioning into private practice is a challenge, and we all go through these challenges. Dental Protection Limited have come out with a new publication called Young Dental Practitioners, with the view to help you in this transition. I'm really happy to be able to tell you about this because that's the whole premise of Dental Head Start as well. In this magazine, there's a couple of great articles. Linda Doan talks about her experiences and challenges, which is really good to see. Mohit Talani talks about the toxic workplace and how to help that and what challenges that can face. We all see these things in general practice, and it's great to have this insight, so check it out. One of the reasons I'm pleased to partner with Dental Protection Limited is because they have these resources for you. They have their survival guide section on their website, they have the Young Dental Practitioner webinar series, and they also have the e-learning platform Prism, which is something where there are lots of talks and things where you can get a lot of great information as part of your membership. The last one is sign up for their e-newsletter, the RiskWise Connect. They've got little stories and snippets there that'll keep you out of trouble. After all, dental protection by your insurer is not just about getting you out of trouble, perhaps it's about stopping you from getting into trouble. So enjoy these resources and follow them on Facebook at Dental Protection Australia to keep yourself in the loop. Thank you, Harry. There's so much wisdom in what you have to say, and I really enjoy those stories too. Some interesting stuff. I never knew anything about hypnosis, but I think I was almost hypnotized in that chat. So now we've got the Prime Head Start segment with Dr. Philip Palmer on business mistakes. So welcome to the Prime Head Start segment. Today we have Philip Palmer. He's a dentist and he's the founder of Prime Practice. Welcome, Philip. How are you today?
Very well, and thanks very much for having me, David.
It's my pleasure. So this time, and I know you're a dentist, but business is something that you know a lot about as well, and it's something you guys teach. But we don't actually get taught much about business in dental school, and I suspect we make some mistakes as we get out and into business. Is there anything you could share with us about the mistakes you see?
The mistakes that I see are all the mistakes I made myself when I started in practice. And when I started both as an employee and as owning my own practice, the mistakes I made was that I guess the first mistake I made was trying to be friends with staff and not trying to have that little bit of a gap, a little bit of authority or something between me and the staff. I always tried to be their friend, and I think that was a mistake. Mm. I think having that little bit of authority separating you and your staff is a better thing to do. Second thing, I never understood my numbers. I didn't look at numbers. I'd wait till the end of the year. I'd go to the accountant. He'd say I had a good year because I did badly and therefore I don't have to pay tax. Or I had a bad year, which unfortunately meant I had a lot of tax to pay. So whatever it was, I couldn't seem to win, but I didn't understand my business at all. I didn't know if my figures were right. I didn't set goals. I didn't know if my expenses were in the right area or the right percentages or anything else. And the third mistake I made, which was a mistake right from, it took me 10, 15 years to get out over this, maybe even a bit longer, was I made decisions for patients and I didn't offer my patients all the choices that I should have offered them. I'd look at them, think this patient will want that sort of treatment, and I'd offer them. I was regularly wrong, but I didn't understand how wrong till I learned. I didn't know what I didn't know.
One of my favorite sayings, you don't know what you don't know. I think there's two points there that are great, but the last one I want to get into, not obviously, but Being too friendly with our staff can make an issue with authority, and that's something that's important. And then understanding your numbers, goal setting, and all of that is something that a lot of us don't know anything about. So you get into business, you don't think about that. But what you were saying then that really resonated was actually the communication side of things. You know, choosing something for a patient when perhaps that's not what they want. Can you explore that a little bit and how you found your answers to that?
Sure. So I think most dentists fall into the trap early on of thinking all our patients want is the cheapest, quickest solution to their problems.
Mm.
And I'm not saying any patient says, give me the most expensive, longest treatment that I can have. Yeah. But most people, given the choice between cheapest and quickest or the best, there's an awful lot who would choose the better alternatives and let go the quickest and cheapest solution. Dentists who are only offering the cheapest and quickest solutions find it a very demoralizing profession.
Mm.
It's soul destroying if you're doing that sort of dentistry all day, every day, and financially not viable.
And I think, and just projecting my own thoughts, obviously, a lot of us come from a situation where we're students for a long time. Money is really important, so we think that's the only thing, and that can be a mistake. But we won't get into that now. There's a lot more to talk about. Thank you so much for sharing that with us on the Prime Head Start segment. All right, that's everything for this episode of the Dental Head Start podcast. Thank you to our sponsors, Prime Practice, BOQ Specialist, and Dental Protection Limited. They're all great people. They're helping us help you, and I'm really proud to be partnered with these people. The biggest favor you can do me to say you like this is to follow us on our social media pages. Reach out if you do like it or if you have advice. I'd appreciate if you follow us and check out the Foresight Dental Journal. We're so excited to get that out there. You can find out more foresightdental.com/journal. For now, have a great week. We'll catch you next episode.